Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for joining us. Recently, both of Dr. Stephen Meyer's books, Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell, were released in audiobook format. It's a new way to enjoy Meyer's masterful storytelling as he recounts attempts to explain the origin of life and the origin of complex animals. With clarity and patience, Meyer reveals why intelligent design is the theory that best explains the evidence. He uses the very same scientific methods of reasoning as Darwin and his contemporaries, but comes to a very different conclusion. Both books are now available in audiobook format, and over the space of a few episodes, we're bringing to you an extended sample of the audio recording from each. Today, you'll hear the first half of Chapter 1 of Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, narrated by Derek Shetterly.
1. DNA, Darwin, and the Appearance of Design. When James Watson and Francis Crick elucidated the structure of DNA in 1953, they solved one mystery but created another. For almost 100 years after the publication of On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin in 1859, the science of biology rested secure in the knowledge that it had explained one of humankind's most enduring enigmas. From ancient times, observers of living organisms had noted that living things display organized structures that give the appearance of having been deliberately arranged or designed for a purpose. For example, the elegant form and protective covering of the coiled nautilus, the interdependent parts of the eye, the interlocking bones, muscles, and feathers of a bird wing. For the most part, observers took these appearances of design as genuine. Observations of such structures led thinkers as diverse as Plato and Aristotle, Cicero and Maimonides, Boyle and Newton to conclude that behind the exquisite structures of the living world was a designing intelligence. As Newton wrote in his masterpiece, The Optics, "How came the bodies of animals to be contrived with so much art, and for what ends were their several parts? Was the eye contrived without skill in optics, and the ear without knowledge of sounds? And these things being rightly dispatched, does it not appear from phenomena that there is a being incorporeal, living, intelligent?" But with the advent of Darwin, modern science seemed able to explain this appearance of design as the product of a purely undirected process. In The Origin, Darwin argued that the striking appearance of design in living organisms, in particular the way they are so well adapted to their environments, could be explained by natural selection working on random variations, a purely undirected process that nevertheless mimicked the powers of a designing intelligence. Since then, the appearance of design in living things has been understood by most biologists to be an illusion, a powerfully suggestive illusion, but an illusion nonetheless. As Crick himself put it 35 years after he and Watson discerned the structure of DNA, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. But due in large measure to Watson and Crick's own discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA, scientists have become increasingly, and in some quarters, acutely aware that there is at least one appearance of design in biology that may not yet have been adequately explained by natural selection, or any other purely natural mechanism. Indeed, when Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, they also discovered that DNA stores information using a 4-character chemical alphabet. Strings of precisely sequenced chemicals called nucleotide bases store and transmit the assembly instructions, the information, for building the crucial protein molecules and machines the cell needs to survive. Crick later developed this idea in his famous sequence hypothesis, according to which the chemical parts of DNA, the nucleotide bases, function like letters in a written language or symbols in a computer code. Just as letters in an English sentence or digital characters in a computer program may convey information depending on their arrangement, so too do certain sequences of chemical bases along the spine of the DNA molecule convey precise instructions for building proteins. Like the precisely arranged zeros and ones in a computer program, the chemical bases in DNA convey information in virtue of their specificity. As Richard Dawkins notes, the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Software developer Bill Gates goes further. DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software ever created. But if this is true, how did the information in DNA arise? Is this striking appearance of design the product of actual design or of a natural process that can mimic the powers of a designing intelligence? As it turns out, this question is related to a long-standing mystery in biology, the question of the origin of the first life. Indeed, since Watson and Crick's discovery, scientists have increasingly come to understand the centrality of information to even the simplest living systems. DNA stores the assembly instructions for building the many crucial proteins and protein machines that service and maintain even the most primitive one-celled organisms. It follows that building a living cell in the first place requires assembly instructions stored in DNA or some equivalent molecule. As Origin of Life researcher Bernd Olaf Kuipers explains, the problem of the origin of life is clearly basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of biological information. Much has been discovered in molecular and cell biology since Watson and Crick's revolutionary discovery more than 50 years ago. But these discoveries have deepened rather than mitigated the enigma of DNA. Indeed, the problem of the origin of life and the origin of the information needed to produce it remains so vexing that Harvard University recently announced a $100 million research program to address it. When Watson and Crick discovered the structure and information-bearing properties of DNA, they did indeed solve one mystery, namely the secret of how the cell stores and transmits hereditary information. But they uncovered another mystery that remains with us to this day. This is the DNA enigma, the mystery of the origin of the information needed to build the first living organism. In one respect, of course, the growing awareness of the reality of information within living things makes life seem more comprehensible. We live in a technological culture familiar with the utility of information. We buy information, we sell it, and we send it down wires. We devise machines to store and retrieve it. We pay programmers and writers to create it. And we enact laws to protect the intellectual property of those who do. Our actions show that we not only value information, but that we regard it as a real entity, on par with matter and energy. That living systems also contain information and depend on it for their existence makes it possible for us to understand the function of biological organisms by reference to our own familiar technology. Biologists have also come to understand the utility of information, in particular for the operation of living systems. After the early 1960s, advances in the field of molecular biology made clear that the digital information in DNA was only part of a complex information processing system, an advanced form of nanotechnology that mirrors and exceeds our own in its complexity, storage density, and logic of design. Over the last 50 years, biology has advanced as scientists have come to understand more about how information in the cell is stored, transferred, edited, and used to construct sophisticated machines and circuits made of proteins. The importance of information to the study of life is perhaps nowhere more obvious than in the emerging fields of genomics and bioinformatics. Over the last decade, scientists involved in these disciplines have begun to map, character by character, the complete sequence of the genetic instructions stored on the human genome, and those of many other species. With the completion of the Human Genome Project in 2000, the emerging field of bioinformatics entered a new era of public interest. News organizations around the world carried President Clinton's announcement of the project's completion on the White House lawn as Francis Collins, scientific director of the project, described the genome as a book, a repository of instructions, and the book of life. The Human Genome Project, perhaps more than any discovery since the elucidation of the structure of DNA in 1953, has heightened public awareness of the importance of information to living things. If Watson and Crick's discovery showed that DNA stores a genetic text, Francis Collins and his team took a huge step toward deciphering its message. Biology has irrevocably entered an information age. In another way, however, the reality of information within living things makes life seem more mysterious. For one thing, it is difficult to understand exactly what information is. When a personal assistant in New York types a dictation and then prints and sends the result via fax to Los Angeles, something will arrive in L.A. But that thing, the paper coming out of the fax machine, did not originate in New York. Only the information on the paper came from New York. No single physical substance, not the air that carried the boss's words to the dictaphone, or the recording tape in the tiny machine, or the paper that entered the fax in New York, or the ink on the paper coming out of the fax in Los Angeles, traveled all the way from sender to receiver. Yet, something did. The elusive character of information, whether biological or otherwise, has made it difficult to define by reference to standard scientific categories. As evolutionary biologist George Williams notes, you can speak of galaxies and particles of dust in the same terms because they both have mass and charge and length and width, but you can't do that with information and matter. A blank magnetic tape, for example, weighs just as much as one loaded with new software, or with the entire sequence of the human genome. Though these tapes differ in information content and value, they do not do so because of differences in their material composition or mass. As Williams concludes, information doesn't have mass or charge or length in millimeters. Likewise, matter doesn't have bytes. This dearth of shared descriptors makes matter and information two separate domains. When scientists during the late 1940s began to define information, they did not make reference to physical parameters such as mass, charge, or watts. Instead, they defined information by reference to a psychological state, the reduction of uncertainty, which they proposed to measure using the mathematical concept of probability. The more improbable a sequence of characters or signals, the more uncertainty it reduces, and thus the more information it conveys. Not surprisingly, some writers have come close to equating information with thought itself. The information technology guru George Gilder, for example, notes that developments in fiber optics have allowed more and more information to travel down smaller and lighter wires. Thus, he notes that as technology advances, we convey ever more thought across ever less matter, where the numerator in that ratio, namely thought, corresponds precisely to information. So should we think of information as thought, as a kind of mental chimera etched in stone or burned onto compact discs? Or can we define information less abstractly as, perhaps, just an improbable arrangement of matter? Whatever information is, whether thought or an elaborate arrangement of matter, one thing seems clear. What humans recognize as information certainly originates from thought, from conscious or intelligent activity. A message received via fax by one person first arose as an idea in the mind of another. The software stored and sold on a compact disc resulted from the design of a software engineer. The great works of literature began first as ideas in the minds of writers, Tolstoy, Austin, or Donne. Our experience of the world shows that what we recognize as information invariably reflects the prior activity of conscious and intelligent persons. What, then, should we make of the presence of information in living organisms? The Human Genome Project, among many other developments in modern biology, has pressed this question to the forefront of public awareness. We now know that we do not just create information in our own technology. We also find it in our biology, and indeed in the cells of every living organism on Earth. But how did this information arise? And what does the presence of information in even the simplest living cell imply about life and its origin? Who or what wrote the Book of Life? The information age in biology officially began in the mid-1950s with the elucidation of the chemical structure and information-bearing properties of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, the molecule of heredity. Beginning in 1953, with their now famous communication to the British scientific journal Nature, James Watson and Francis Crick identified DNA as the molecular repository of genetic information. Subsequent developments in the field of molecular biology confirmed this idea and showed that the precisely sequenced bases attached to the helical backbone of DNA store the information for building proteins, the sophisticated enzymes and machines that service the cells in all living things. Though the discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA dates back over half a century, the recognition of the full significance of this discovery has been slow in coming. Many scientists have found it difficult to relinquish an exclusive reliance upon the more traditional scientific categories of matter and energy. As George Williams, himself an evolutionary biologist, notes, "Evolutionary biologists have failed to realize that they work with two more or less incommensurable domains, that of information and that of matter. The gene is a package of information, not an object. The pattern of base pairs in a DNA molecule specifies the gene. But the DNA molecule is the medium. It's not the message." Yet this recognition begs deeper questions. What does it mean when we find information in natural objects, living cells, that we did not ourselves design or create? As the information theorist Hubert Yockey observes, the genetic code is constructed to confront and solve the problems of communication and recording by the same principles found in modern communication and computer codes. Yockey notes that the technology of information theory and coding theory has been in place in biology for at least 3.85 billion years, or from the time that life first originated on Earth. What should we make of this fact? How did the information in life first arise? Our common sense reasoning might lead us to conclude that the information necessary to the first life, like the information in human technology or literature, arose from a designing intelligence. But modern evolutionary biology rejects this idea. Many evolutionary biologists admit, of course, that living organisms appear to have been carefully and artfully designed, as Richard Lewontin puts it. As Richard Dawkins states, biology is the study of complex things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. Nevertheless, Lewontin and Dawkins, like evolutionary biologists generally, insist that the appearance of design in life is illusory. Life, they say, looks designed, but was not designed by an actual intelligent or purposive agent. Darwin's designer substitute. Why do evolutionary biologists so confidently assert that the appearance of design in living organisms is illusory? Of course, the answer to this question is well known. Evolutionary biologists have a theory that can apparently explain, or explain away, the appearance of design without invoking an actual designer. According to classical Darwinism, and now modern neo-Darwinism, the mechanism of natural selection acting on random variations, or mutations, can mimic the effects of intelligence, even though the mechanism is, of course, entirely blind, impersonal, and undirected. Darwin developed his principle of natural selection by drawing on an analogy with artificial selection, the process of selective breeding to change the characteristics, whether anatomical, physiological, or behavioral, of a group of organisms. For example, a farmer might observe that some of his young stallions are faster than others. If he allows only the fastest of those to breed with the fastest mares, then, after several generations of selective breeding, he will own a small group of speedy thoroughbreds suitable for racing on the downs. Darwin realized that nature could imitate this process of selective breeding. The presence of unusually fast predatory wild cats would imperil all but the fastest horses in a wild herd. After several generations of such predatory challenge, the speed of the remaining herd might exhibit a discernible increase. Thus, environmental forces, predators, changes in weather, competition for food, etc., could accomplish the work of a human breeder. By causing a population to adapt to its environment, blind forces of nature could come to mimic, over time, the action of a selecting or designing intelligence. Yet, if natural selection, as Darwin called this process, could improve the speed of a horse or an antelope, why couldn't it also produce those animals in the first place? Reason, wrote Darwin, ought to conquer imagination. Namely, our incredulity about the possibility of such happenings and our impression that living things appear to have been designed. According to Darwin, if given enough time, nature's selective power might act on any variation perfecting any structure or function far beyond what any human could accomplish. Thus, the complex systems in life that we reflexively attribute to intelligence have wholly natural causes. As Darwin explained, there seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course which the wind blows. Or, as evolutionary biologist Francisco Ayala explains, the functional design of organisms and their features would seem to argue for the existence of a designer. It was Darwin's greatest accomplishment, however, to show that the directive organization of living beings can be explained as the result of a natural process, natural selection, without any need to resort to a creator or other external agent. Thus, Ayala and other Darwinian biologists not only affirm that natural selection can produce design without a designer, they also assert that it is creative without being conscious. The appearance of design. To many outside evolutionary biology, the claim that design arises without a designer may seem inherently contradictory. Yet, in theory at least, the possibility that life is not what it seems represents nothing particularly unusual. Science often shows that our perceptions of nature do not match reality. A straight pencil appears bent when inserted in a glass of water. The sun appears to circle the earth, and the continents appear immobile. Perhaps living organisms only appear to be designed. Even so, there is something curious about the scientific denial of our ordinary intuition about living things. For almost 150 years, since its putative explanation by Darwinian theory, this impression of design persists as incorrigibly as ever. Public opinion polls suggest that nearly 90% of the American public does not accept the full-fledged neo-Darwinian account of evolution with its denial of any role for a purposeful creator. Though many of these people accept some form of evolutionary change and have a high view of science generally, they apparently cannot bring themselves to repudiate their deepest intuitions and convictions about the design of the living world. In every generation since the 1860s, scientific critics of Darwinism and neo-Darwinism have arisen, marshaling serious evidential objections to the theory. Since the 1980s, a growing number of scientists and scholars have expressed deep reservations about both biological and chemical evolutionary theory, each with their implicit denial of design. And even orthodox evolutionary biologists admit the overwhelming impression of design in modern organisms. To quote Francis Crick again, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Perhaps more curiously, modern biologists can scarcely describe living organisms without resorting to language that seems to imply the very thing they explicitly deny, intentional and purposive design. As philosopher of science Michael Ruse notes, biologists ask about the purpose of the fins on the back of the Stegosaurus, or the function of the bird's feathers, and discuss whether the Irish elk's antlers did or did not exist in order to intimidate rivals. It is true, Ruse continues, that during the 19th century, some physicists suggested that the moon exists in order to light the way home of lonely travelers, but no physicist would use such language today. In biology, however, especially evolutionary biology, this kind of talk is commonplace. He concludes, the world of the evolutionist is drenched in the anthropomorphism of intention. And yet, paradoxically, even the severest critics of such intentional language slip into it for the sake of convenience. In theory, at least, the use of such metaphor in science derives from ignorance. Physicists talk about gravitational attraction because they don't really know what causes action at a distance. Metaphors reign where mystery resides. Yet, on these grounds, we might have expected that as biology advanced, as new discoveries explicated the molecular basis of biological functions, biology's reliance upon the language of purpose, upon teleological metaphor, might have diminished. Yet the very opposite has taken place. The advent of the most reductionistic subdiscipline of modern biology, molecular biology, has only deepened our dependence on teleological language. In fact, molecular biologists have introduced a new high-tech teleology, taking expressions, often self-consciously, from communication theory, electrical engineering, and computer science. The vocabulary of modern molecular and cell biology includes apparently accurate descriptive terms that nevertheless seem laden with metaphysics of intention, genetic code, genetic information, transcription, translation, editing enzymes, signal transduction circuitry, feedback loop, and information processing system. As Richard Dawkins notes, apart from differences in jargon, the pages of a molecular biology journal might be interchanged with those of a computer engineering journal. As if to underscore the point, University of Chicago cell biologist James Shapiro describes the integrated system of proteins that constitutes the mammalian blood clotting system as a powerful real-time distributed computing system. In the same context, he notes that many biochemical systems within the cell resemble the wiring diagram for an electronic circuit. As the historian of biology Timothy Lenoir observes, teleological thinking has been steadfastly resisted by modern biology. And yet, in nearly every area of research, biologists are hard-pressed to find language that does not impute purposiveness to living forms. Thus, it seems that an acquaintance with biological organisms, to say nothing of the molecular biology of the cell, leads even those who repudiate design to use language that seems incompatible with their own reductionistic and Darwinian perspective, with their official denial of actual design. Although this may ultimately signify nothing, it does at least raise a question. Does the persistence of our perception of design and the use of incorrigibly teleological language indicate anything about the origin of life or the adequacy of scientific theories that deny actual design in the origin of living systems? As always, in science, the answer to such questions depends entirely on the justification that scientists can provide for their theories. Intuitions and perceptions can be right or wrong. It may well be, as many in biology assure us, that public and even scientific doubts about evolutionary theory derive solely from ignorance or religious prejudice, and that teleological language reflects nothing more than a metaphor of convenience, like saying the sun has set behind the horizon. Yet the persistence of dissenting scientific opinion and the inability of biologists to avoid the language of purpose raise a pardonable curiosity. Have evolutionary biologists discovered the true cause of the appearance of design in living systems? Or should we look for another? Should we trust our intuitions about living organisms or accept the standard evolutionary account of biological origins?
That's it for today. On another episode, we'll share the second half of Chapter 1 of Signature in the Cell, the audiobook version. We'd like to thank Harper One for permission to share the recording with you. Until next time, I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.